time, but on the other hand, they're pretty rapidly through the material, and so you have to be pretty attentive. But I put it all on transparency, so that's how I get into a lot of material without it necessarily going in. Reformulating geometry, space-time, into a different geometrical framework. The geometry is something which is related to space-time geometry in a non-local way, and although initially it's something quite equivalent to the normal space-time descriptions, at least in flat space, one has a different, sort of presents a different angle on how to proceed, and so that one's stuck, perhaps, in any problem in basic physics, at least it might get a different way of approaching that problem, essentially because the geometry is from a completely different language. Now, one of the basic features of geometry is it's complex, and the idea is that by using something which is essentially complex, one could fit in with the ideas of quantum mechanics in a much more direct way. So one of the essential basic ideas of crystal theory is that the hope is that it combines in a much more intimate way the geometry with the quantum mechanics. And the description is essentially a complex description, that is, the functions one comes up with tend to be complex analytic functions. It's using the complex structure of the geometry. Another feature which is important in description of is essentially bound up with the dimension and signature of space-time. One couldn't simply change the dimension of space or the signature of space and hope to have a just corresponding formula. It doesn't mean you can't do anything in other dimensions or other signatures, but the twisted theory is very much tied into this particular dimension and signature, and one can't just change the number of pluses or the number of minuses or the number of dimensions all together and hope to have an exact corresponding theory.
Now, do you mean the actual number of plus and minuses or any kind of sign?
Well, I'm not worried about that very much. I prefer to have three minuses in the plus, but that's the way.
No, I don't want to be that kind of thing.
No, you change the sign all the way through. The minus signs are more convenient when one's dealing with spinners, and spinners are very much part of twisted theory. And so, for that reason alone, it would be a little bit less convenient for you to pass around the minus plus plus plus. But that's not a problem. Important. Let me mention just some areas of application. For general relativity, although there's a lot yet that we don't understand about how to code general relativity into twisted theory, it's, at the moment it deals most completely with half flat space or self-dual solutions to Einstein's equations, and they're not really general relativity. But there are some indications that one should be able to do more, but this is one of the areas where one has a lot of problems which certainly nowhere near being solved, such as finding how to, in a nice way, how to represent the general real solution of Einstein's equations in terms of twisted theory. So far it's only the self-dual ones that one can do in a decent way. And Richard Ward, I think, will say something about this. Related to this is the corresponding treatment of Gary Mills' theory, Crystal seemed to lead to a nice way of handling self-dual fields, whether they be referring to general relativity or to angles. We'll hear about this later. There is a program for particle physics within the Crystal scheme, and then we'll hear also more about that. Then Houston and Bruce Carlyle said something about this. And quantum field theory, well, there's a lot more that needs to be done in trying to translate quantum field theory into crystal form, but there are a number of suggested things that come out of this. And Andrew Hodges will be saying something about that. And then, well, this is that's just meant to put in the application of quantum theory. There are things like, well, handling multiple moments, for example, there are a number of other applications that don't have to come under these headings. Now, what about, let's say something about the basic geometry. Those of you who have heard me talk about Crystal before will notice a certain similarity in this talk and the other talk. One of the most primitive places in which there is an interrelation between space-time structure and quantum mechanics is in the treatment of spin half, non-relativistic spin half, where one has two basic states, let's say up and down, and then you take any complex linear combination of those to build up all other possible states, and the pure states all correspond to spin in a particular direction. Now, if you represent that direction on sphere, this is the Thorvaldsen Riemann sphere, the complex number, which is the ratio of these two complex parameters here. And you can call that the R1 plane, zeta, is this point here, and this simply represents the direction according to this sphere of projection. So this is well known. But it always struck me that one has here a close relationship between the use of complex numbers, which shows up in the fact that you have a two-dimensional Riemann sphere, and the fact that you'll have three space dimensions. So one doesn't have such an interrelation between quantum mechanics and space-time structure in other dimensions. It's something which seems to fit particularly well, three space dimensions. And this has to do with the fact that the group SU2 is 2-1 isomorphic with the rotation group SO3, it's just an expression of this isomorphism. Well, how about carrying this a little bit further? This is non-relativistic. What can one say about relativistic? Well, there's a relativistic version of this group, which gets us to SO2C. SO2C is 2-1 isomorphic with the connected component of the Lorentz group, 013, or 031, carrying the we can think of this as well, the sphere can be seen as, well, it's exactly can be seen as the celestial sphere. You have an observer, say, supposedly sitting out in space, looking out at the stars, and the light rays that come to him from the different stars, he tends to map on the sphere, and that's the celestial sphere. Now you can think of that again as a Riemann sphere, and we're using the same here, of course. And then the transformations, if you go from one observer to another at this point, the different velocities have to rotate relative to each other, and the transformation of the zeta from one to the other will be given by these fractional linear transformations. The Lorentz group is simply represented in this way. And incidentally, one can think of the sphere as being simply a complex manifold, or one of the simplest one-dimensional complex manifold, compact complex manifold, topology of the complex structure, corresponding to the formal structure here. Then the self-transformations of that will preserve the complex structure of precisely these. So I think of the Lorentz group as being the maps of this very simple complex manifold itself. Now, if we want to continue this a little further, but this is only at one point, in other places. We get a more complete picture of space-time. Space-time now and have all these different photons traveling along, sample them into the eye of the observer, and that gives us a picture of X4, some delta. Now, if you also do this a little bit more correctly, the problem with these photons, they're still some classical photons, I'll describe a little bit more accurately in terms of this. Is, but you can think of them as having an angular momentum spin in the direction of motion. So these are meant to be right-handed photons. And think of the space of right-handed classical photons. This is something which has six real dimensions. The six real dimensional space can be interpreted as a complex manifold of three dimensions, and there it is over here, half of free space, factor 2 here, and any point here corresponds uniquely to one of these possible photons. And the different photons entering this chap's eye here, I'm slightly cheating when I say this, correspond to this particular submanifold of this complex space, which is the sphere that basically is going to talk. This is then the space of classical right-handed photons. It's half of the complex projective free space. The other half can be thought of as the left-handed classical photons. And then the boundary between the two corresponds to the high energy limit of the photons. So that they're not quite localized in space-time when the spin is present, but if you let the energy go up and up and up, then the spin becomes less and less important, and they become more and more localized as an null line. Points on the boundary can then be thought of as representing the null lines in space-time. So the all these different places. This picture here is the projected twisted space. The points of projected twisted space correspond either to right-handed photons, to left-handed photons, or to null lines in cosmic space. Strictly speaking, the pattern of space. About this. First of all, to describe a particle which can have spin, we think in terms of the momentum and the angular momentum. And angular momentum, of course, is something which occurs in origin. So if we have a momentum and angular momentum at this origin, then we have to know what they're going to be at this origin. There's a simple formula, square brackets meaning c part, which relates the angular momentum at any point to the angular momentum at the origin. If you believe the angular momentum is a very certain kind of field, if you like, a very particular type of space-time dependence, of course the momentum is a constant field. Well, then, this will hold for any classical system, momentum, angular momentum, but now, suppose we make a system which describes a massive particle, then the momentum has to be null and future pointing. That's one condition. Second condition is that the spin vector, the Pavlovsky spin vector, which is constructed using this formula, P being the normal alternating tensor, then the Pavlovsky spin vector has to be in the direction of momentum, or opposite to it, the factor of proportionality being the felicity, plus or minus. Zero. Now, just in order to handle these things, it's convenient to introduce a spinner notation. Spinner notation, well, these are my conventions are plus, minus, minus, minus for the metric. And that's the alternating tensor. Introduce two spinners, raising the lower intensity derivatives using the spinner epsilon, turn it to 1, minus 1, noughts. One of the points about spinners is that you can use them to translate any space-time vector into a spinner form, spinners being now two-dimensional, two complex-dimensional. Complex vectors are related to the complex spinners, where you have the product of the spin space and the conjugate spin space. Prime indices indicate the conjugate spin space. And the relation in simple coordinates is given by these familiar matrices over here. Real vectors B corresponding to Hermitian matrices. These matrices are Hermitian if the vector B is real. That's the standard way of translating into two spinners. If you do that, and then you take one of these massless systems, you find that they can be described in terms of two component spinners, pi and omega. So because pi is a future pointing null vector, you can represent it as the product of a two spinner with its complex conjugate. Complex conjugation takes the prime and non-prime indices into each other. The skew symmetrical angular momentum, where each index gets translated into the skew, so you have four spinner indices, and they you can show that if conditions 1 and 2 hold, then you can always represent M as a symmetrized product of the original spinner pi with another one omega, put in an I and an epsilon, and add the complex conjugate. I won't go into the arguments as to why that's the case, but it's not hard to show. In fact, omega and pi are the two parts of a twister. They correspond to momentum and angular momentum. They correspond up to a phase. That is, if I know omega and pi, of course I can construct m and p. And when, incidentally, when I don't put any noughts or x's, you can think of these m's and p's as referring to some standard origin. So please say I'll refer to something that already for this one. If you know omega and pi, of course you can construct p. If you know m and p and they satisfy the conditions, these have got automatic consequences in these formulae. If you have m and p, then z is uniquely determined up to a phase. There's a phase multiplier for z, but apart from that, the z is unique. Z just is this pair over one pi. Going the other way, provided pi is not zero, I should say, you could go the other way. If pi is zero, then this is just general. If you go the other way, the momentum becomes zero. Well, if you write down the components, z naught equals omega naught, etc., etc., then explicitly, some people like explicit things, you have more out there. Not sure that helps any, but same as the formula that we can get written up. Well, now we want to represent the change of origin. How does that what does that look like in terms of the omegas and pi's? Well, the pi is independent of the origin, p is independent, so it's natural. Pi to be independent. Omega then corresponds, omega for x corresponds omega for O, I mean to this formula. Okay, incidentally, I should have mentioned I tend to be using abstract indices, that's what I was saying somewhere here. That tends if you go back and just imagine wherever you see a few of the formula that is, you imagine some kind of sigma sitting in between which translates these indices and these. It's not important. Out of the way. Anyway, so the x position vector becomes a spinner with two indices, one of each kind, and the omega upon x is related to the origin of the formula. There's another way of looking at this formula, and that is in terms of the twister equation. The twister equation, so if you take this formula here, regard omega, look at the origin and part of the origin as constants, and look at the x dependence, you differentiate, you find it once it satisfies this equation here. Conversely, it's not hard to show that if omega satisfies this equation, then it has this particular type of dependence for some omega and pi. So it's an equivalent way of looking at a twister. There are all sorts of different ways of looking at this. This is one of the reasons twister theory is confusing, I think, is that not, if there was just one way which was correct to look at twisters, and if you make life much easier, there's all these different ways, and one has to worry about how they relate to one another. And one way is in terms of the momentum and angular momentum, which I just started with. Another way is in terms of the twister equation. You could say, well, the twister is a solution of this equation. That would be a way of proceeding. In fact, the solution of this equation, as I said, show has this form. And then we go back to the angular momentum today. I don't think I want to say too much about this particular method of talking about twisters. One of the ways it is convenient is that it enables you to very directly to get at the conformal invariant equations. This particular equation here is a conformal invariant equation. So if you have one solution, you simply go to another metric, then the del transforms to the appropriate connection with respect to that other metric, and one can show quite rapidly that this equation simply goes over into itself. So that if you want to see the conformal properties of twisters, this is quite a useful way of describing twisters. As I say, I won't say too much about that. Perhaps I should mention one other way this formula is useful. If you want to go from solutions of the zero rest Pascal equations from one spin to another, you find that maybe you have to stick in and go from one to the next, it ends up the solution of that equation. It's another way of looking at twisters. I think I won't go into that though. But Felicity. Now we had this one little s, which related the Pauli-Lubansky spin vector to the momentum vector. What is it in terms of omega pi? But this expression here, a half omega pi bar plus pi omega bar. And this is an important quantity, the Felicity, and it suggests, other things also suggest, but this is one way of suggesting what the form of the complex conjugate of the twister ought to be. So this Felicity then is the norm, essentially, of the twister Z. If you define Z bar, here's Z over here, Z is omega pi, then Z bar is to be complex conjugate of omega pi but swapped around in the opposite direction. So when you take the scalar product of these two, that gets multiplied by that, and that by that, and you add them up. This is a conformally invariant thing, so that's leading to the scalar products of the omega directions. That's another reason why one's concerned with this. Also, this form, ZZ bar, if you reduce that to diagonal form, it's plus plus minus minus. It's a permission form with that signature. And in fact, like I mentioned a moment ago, the group SU22, well, I'll mention it again in a moment, but this is, if you think of the linear transformations of Z, complex linear transformations of Z, preserve, nevertheless, preserve this expression. And a unit is shown. That is the SU22. In fact, this is conformally invariant. is what gives you this correspondence between the conformal group and the group SU22. Well, let's now look at twisters in a somewhat different way. Now let's talk about complex space-time. See, suppose we take this top line here, and we take a particular twister, and we take a particular omega pi, and we look for those places where the field omega of x vanishes. Well, these solutions are given here. See, omega naught is omega of pi naught is pi, and if omega here is zero, that's when is this equation satisfied here. So the zeros of this field of omegas are the solutions of this equation. Well, we can think of this as that's another way of looking at twisters. We think of this as a basic relation here, which relates space-time points, these x's are really the position vectors, space-time points, which relates space-time points to the pair omega pi, which is to Z. We define a relation, x lies on Z, to be this equation holds. Or sometimes you may say Z lies on X, so Z passes through X or X passes through Z, all these terms are changing. In order to have a solution of this equation in general, we need X to be complex. If X were real, this will only have a solution if little s is zero. But that's pretty restrictive. And here the solutions are drawn on this plane, you see. Suppose we have one solution, that's X there. In a complex, you always have one solution provided pi is not zero. So we've got one solution. Now we're trying to find out where all the other solutions are. Well, all the other solutions are things which, when you plug in the difference between the new solution and the old one in this formula, well, this thing over here will get killed. So there have to be something lambda times pi. Because things of the form lambda times pi are the things which are killed by pi. There's still a metric, excuse me, metrical, and if you raise the index and contract it with itself, it's zero. The converse is also true. So the vectors, any two solutions of this equation, the difference between them has to have the form lambda times pi. Well, that means that this is the spinor translation of a null vector. It's a null vector, but the thing is, pi is fixed, and lambda varies. So you want to think of the space of all null vectors, starting from x, see where all the null vectors get to, which are of the form lambda times pi, where pi is the given pi. And in fact, these are all going to be orthogonal to one another, all these vectors. Not only are they null, but any two of them are orthogonal. And this follows because if you take two things of this form, stick them together, the lambda has been different, but the pi's been the same, the pi's will knock each other out, irrespective of what lambda is. So you find that these vectors are all orthogonal to one another and all null. So this is what we call a totally null two-plane, it's a two-dimensional plane, it's two complex parameters. As lambda, we have two complex parameters in lambda, and every two directions in it are orthogonal and null. We call that alpha plane. We could correspondingly talk about beta planes. Beta planes are the same correspondingly the other way around, but where the roles of the prime and non-prime indices are changed. That is, you now let pi be fixed, pi vary and lambda be fixed. And that gives you a plane of the opposite kind, which we call a beta plane. And the beta planes correspond to the dual type of twister, or the complex conjugate type of twister. So the alpha planes correspond to the upstairs twisters with the indices at the top. The beta planes, where lambda is fixed and pi varies, correspond to the downstairs twisters. So the complex conjugation relation pushes the index down, so they're the dual type of object. And the lambda and mu are two spinner parts of the twister over the W, then we have the corresponding relation. X lies on W will be that. Now this picture here is projective twister space. That is to say, a twister up to proportionality, a twister Z up to proportionality, represents a point in this space. Often very convenient to use the projective twister space when one's talking about geometry. It's usually geometrical concepts show up easier to handle when we're talking about projective space rather than twister space. So any two twisters which are related by a non-zero complex multiple, as here, represent the same point. So this is a complex projective free space here. And the points Z correspond to the alpha planes in the complex space. So if we look at all the different alpha planes from complexified Minkowski space, they give us different points in this complex projective free space. I should say this includes infinity as well as complexified and compactified Minkowski space. I'll say a little bit more about compactified space in a moment. Just to get the complete picture, you really need that. You need more info. And the beta planes in that will correspond to planes, they're the dual object over here in this space. So we have this correspondence between space-time and the projective twister space, or let's say complex space-time and projective twister space. Points in projective twister space correspond to the alpha planes in complex space-time. Planes in projective twister space correspond to the beta planes in space-time. The lines in projective twister space correspond to the points of space-time. You see, it all comes out of this formula here. If you want to know what a line corresponds to, the alpha plane is given when you fix only at pi and then x vary. There's all the different x's, that's the translation. But now suppose we fix x and then omega and pi vary. Well, this just gives us a relation between omega and pi. and apart from a few odd ones out of infinity, the general two-dimensional linear subspace of the twister space can be written in that form. And that tells us that X corresponds to two-dimensional linear subspace of twister space. Go to the triple space now, that will be the line. The points in cosmic space, specified in cosmic space, the lines in the triple space. And we have various incidence relations now. X like on Z means that the line now passes through Z. So when I say line down and passes through, I'm going to use change it. Depends on whether we're talking over here or over here. See, X passes through Z corresponds to X line on Z. When we go to the dual object, it's the X lies on W, which corresponds to X lies on W here. It's the instance property, no one in the P, so that's in the line to the line of W. I don't doubt it doesn't. If it does, then the point here is on the plane here. If the line doesn't lie on the plane there, then this point is not. Well, I said I won't really say anything more about this, but just before I take the transparency away, you mentioned you get another way, just to confuse people, you get another way of thinking about twisters. If you think of the field of omegas, it's simply a kind of field on space time. Now, I think the omegas point along null directions as x squared. And these null directions give us a field of directions of space-time, and this could be a way of looking at the twister. And if you want to get a nice geometrical, real geometrical picture of the twister, as in real, I mean, not complex geometry, this is a way of doing it. And this corresponds to something called Robinson convexes, which I wrote a little more about that. They're rather pretty, for sure. Right. We should say something a bit more about the real geometry. I was talking about complex geometry. And the thing is that the points in projective twister space, which lie on Pn, that's where the quantity S, the norm, like the Z vanishes, they correspond to the alpha planes, which actually have real. Now, most alpha planes don't have any real points on them at all. But if you find a real point on an alpha plane, then you can find another one by simply letting lambda be proportional to pi bar. So if lambda is a real multiple of pi bar, then this will be a real null direction. So if you find one point on the alpha plane, then anything in that real null direction, which is determined by pi, will also lie on the alpha plane. So as soon as you've got one point on the alpha plane, you've got a whole null direction of points on the alpha plane. Similarly, the beta plane, just the same. So you do have some alpha planes, which where you still do. Most of the alpha planes still are complex, but you can still see null lines work. And in fact, the space then of null lines in compactifying Minkowski space corresponds precisely to those twisters which have zero norm. The zero norm is a condition that they should have one point. That actually follows immediately from the equation set there, but I won't bring that to the slide. So we have this picture now. Points up here correspond to alpha planes. Points down here correspond to alpha planes. But these ones are a positive norm, those are negative norm, the ones are zero norm, correspond to null lines in the constant. In fact, the pictures I had earlier on with the photons, right-handed and left-handed, now can be seen from this description. I was talking about alpha planes, and if you ever want to go back to the momentum and angular momentum, see the Z itself, the big Z, the Z alpha itself defines the value of S, but there's also the phase ambiguity. So if you now forget the actual value of S, just the sign, you retain the sign, and also forget the phase, then the Z proportionality is a finite point. So the points up here, if you normalize S, if you say talk about photons normalized to V1, that means unit velocity objects, then that would be the correspondence between the spinning photons and the points up here. So that gives us the thing, as I said, right? In the you can think of top up to space, the points of it as corresponding to right-handed spinning photons. The points down here, the left-handed spinning photons. You could use any other zero mass particle and normalize with a different value there. Okay, so that's geometry. Okay, now the geometry of real Minkowski space can be related quite closely to Pn. You see, the null lines in Minkowski space, as I said, come from the points of Pn. The points in Minkowski space correspond to the projected line, which happens to lie entirely in Pn. One has the correspondence that if two null lines are set, then you have this orthogonality relation, and it's equivalent. Orthogonality between the twisted holes if and only if they lie in set. That corresponds over here to saying that those two corresponding points have a join which lies entirely in Pn. So one has a very sort of close, sort of dual correspondence between the real Minkowski space and the geometry of Pn. In fact, the fact that Pn geometry, see, this is a complex manifold here, this is a real hypersurface, five dimensional, in that complex manifold. The complex structure produces certain structure on a hypersurface, a real hypersurface. It's called a CR structure, a tangential Cauchy-Rubin structure. And that actually, I won't do it, but the details of that structure can be seen to relate to the structure of complex, of real null lines in the cosmos, whether they're rotational models are here or not. And structure, what's called the CR geometry of this absence. Now, if you go to the complex Minkowski space, you see the real Minkowski space sitting inside complexified Minkowski space. The real point corresponds to a real line over here inside Cn. The complex point corresponds to lines in somewhere else. Now, they can sit in all sorts of different ways in relation to this. If the line lies entirely in the top half, this corresponds to the point in the forward tube. The position vector of the point in the Minkowski space has an imaginary part which minus the imaginary part lies in the particular light curve. Minus the imaginary part lies in the past light curve, this corresponds to the back of the tube. And if the imaginary part is space-like, that corresponds to the line which cuts right across. Bottom. If it's null, then the line will be touched either at the top or the bottom. So there's these different possible arrangements for the line in the space corresponding to the different types of complex position vectors that one can have in the top of space. And one thing one's interested in quantum mechanics, of course, then one's interested in the forward tube, and interested in positivity positions. And that means that one's concerned with crystal space with this top half of crystal space. And this is one of the convenient things about crystal. The description, in fact, is one of the initial motivations, one of the most important initial motivations for crystal theory, was that it has this sort of geometrical way of talking about forward two, which is determined to put the vibrant space into the half. So it's like top half and bottom half of the complex plane, which is an analogy. Yes. When you use Euclidean, you say take time forward and multiply by I, this will correspond to choosing a particular hypersurface in real Minkowski space, where that's where the time forward vanishes, and then you go off in a different direction. Now, so that one has to take a real metric on But that's why the Cosby says it's said a different way. Real measure here. There's nothing else to say. This is